Good morning and welcome to Spotlight 92. I'm your host, Malvin Massey. And of course, every Thursday we talk to the movers and shakers of the Memphis community, the people that are making things happen for your benefit and mine. Our guest today is a good friend and a rhetorician beyond compare. He has taken on the responsibility of being the host this year for the 13th Biennial Public Address Conference. It's here at the University of Memphis this year. It's handled over the 13 years. It's been at a lot of different locations. And it's very exciting that it will be here at the University of Memphis. And we're going to tell you all about that and some of the people that are going to be here and why it's here. Well, the man with all the information, my good friend, Dr. Tony Antonio De Velasco.
Good morning, Malvin. Thanks so much for having me on. This is really my pleasure.
Well, thank you, Tony, and especially thanks for taking on this responsibility, man. This is a major, major responsibility.
You know, we've been at it now for 2 years exactly. This is a conference that started in 1988. Then we're going on basically the 25th year. It's an unusual conference because instead of being organized by a single organization or being held in a particular place, it's moved all over the United States. This is the 12th university that the conference has been at. It's been at universities like Penn State University, the University of Wisconsin, the University of Georgia, Vanderbilt University, Pittsburgh. This is the first time that Memphis has been able to hold the event. Mm. Basically, the process was something like this. About 2 years ago, we got a call from the hosts of the 2010 conference that they were welcoming bids for this event. We put in a bid against two other universities, and Memphis was able to prevail. So that was one of the things that we're particularly proud of, and that is that our program is gaining some national prominence and is doing it enough so that we could attract this meeting to Memphis and to share it with our grad students, with our undergraduate students. Over 3 days, members of the local community are invited. There's just a host of things that are going on around communication.
Yeah, and that has been the question all the time, or at least one of the arguing points about the relevance of the communication department.
Yeah.
The communication discipline. Yeah. And, that's what we do all the time is communicate. And
exactly. I mean, and that's one of the things that I think is so fun about teaching communication. You know, I've been at the University of Memphis since the fall of 2005. One of the things that I have come to appreciate about this university so much is the not simply the involvement of the community, but the way that this university, the walls of this university, do not keep out people from the outside. And that's the thing that is really important. That's a really important thing about what we do in communication. Since I've been here, I've had the privilege of teaching hundreds of students. And one of the things that we focus on in our classrooms is talking to people about how to solve everyday problems and how language can help us do that and how it sometimes hurts us. Now, This conference in particular is about the notion of civic learning. What does that mean? Essentially, what that means is learning how to live together with people that are not exactly like you.
Yeah.
We live in a complex society. The city of Memphis, the Shelby County, is changing every day. It's growing. It's becoming more diverse. How do we talk about that? How do we deal with problems? We know that we've got controversies in our community over all kinds of things. Over crime, over schools, over jobs. Who has the best answer to these problems? Well, lots of people claim to have that answer. How do you decide who's got the right one?
Right.
Well, you don't want to just go with the people that you know. You want to be able to listen and talk and argue. That's what we do in the Department of Communication. That's what this conference is about.
Yeah. And the speeches, another thing that makes it so cool and prestigious is that the speeches or the speakers come from all over the country, and they are all extremely proficient in what they do.
Yeah, I mean, this is a kind of a treat, and maybe folks in your listening audience who aren't in the habit of going to academic conferences may not appreciate this as much. But I'll tell you what I find particularly interesting about this is a lot of conferences are not as exclusive, basically, as this one.
Okay.
We've got 8 panels at this conference. Every single one of the speakers, all of their respondents were invited by us. They didn't call they didn't submit proposals to have their papers delivered. What we did was we said, who are the best, and we've got 32 of them, national scholars on this issue that we can find to come to Memphis on one weekend and talk about this topic. I was the person that sent out the invitations. We only had 2 people say they couldn't do it because they had other commitments. This is a conference that the top scholars in our field want to come to. when they don't get invited, they don't like it. So there are some people who wish they were coming that aren't.
Yeah.
And so I think that one of the things that you're talking about that's particularly distinctive about this is that a lot of times if you go to an academic conference, there may be several panels going on at the same time. Here we've got them, there's only one at a time, and it's about, we've got about 130 people who have paid to go to the conference. And what this means is that all of them at once are going to be focusing on one paper. We've got extended time for commentary, question and answer after the talks. A lot of other conferences don't have that. What they may have is 10 panels going on at 9 o'clock in the morning, and you decide which one you go to.
Yeah.
In this case, what we've done is we've assembled the best of the best. We've put them in the role of speaker, and we've also put them in the audience. There are people who are traveling from, for example, we've got a crew coming from Colorado, a bunch of graduate students and professors. They aren't presenting. Why are they coming all the way to Memphis? They're coming here because they want to be around the best scholars in our field, and they want to be able to ask them questions, perhaps to challenge them. My hope, at least, is that in some of these talks will provoke debate. Maybe even vigorous debate. After all, that's what communication is about. It's not about just agreeing. It's about talking and hashing out our differences.
Yeah, that class that I'm taking now, interpersonal communication. That's
yes.
This is the essence of what we're talking
about.
Yeah,
that's
class,
right. Yeah, man. Yeah.
And one of the speakers, as a matter of fact, one thing I want to get into first early in this conversation so we can come back to it is the legacies of civic action and leadership from the truth-telling woman.
Oh.
Now, this one starts at 4:30 this afternoon.
That's right.
I've been trying to get Tony over here to do this for a while, but we've been talking about it, and he's been busy. But Ida B. Wells, who is a Memphian, part of the Memphis heritage and history from many years ago, she is going to be represented by a guest lecturer by the name of Jacqueline Jones Royster, who's the dean of Ivan Allen College of Liberal Arts and Georgia Institute of Technology at Georgia Tech.
Yes.
This lady is, she's probably one of the foremost authorities on Ida B. Wells, isn't she?
This is really, and this is an event, Malvin, that has grown ever since we decided to have this conference right from the very beginning. One of the first suggestions that was made to me by a scholar from Northwestern University was, if you're doing a conference on rhetoric in Memphis, what about Ida B. Wells? We need to have something on Ida B. Wells. And I thought, that sounds to me like a great idea.
Yeah.
The first person that came to mind was Jackie Royster. Professor Royster is somebody who really is unparalleled in her field. She has published several scholarly books, and in particular, the one that was the most there's two that are really remarkable when it comes to how it relates to this talk. One of them is a book called Traces of a Stream, and what she did in that book, and that was published in 2000, was she did something that no one had ever done, and that was to ask the question: how was it that African American women in the United States in the late 19th century and the early 20th century were educated for public speaking? This was a time, of course, in our nation's history when not only were women denied the franchise to vote.
All women.
But this was an African-American woman who was born in Holly Springs, Mississippi, not very far from us in a rural upbringing. She ended up, Ida B. Wells ended up basically taking care of her young siblings. She didn't have a partner with her to help her. Her parents were around, but they weren't around by the time that she became a young woman in her 20s. And so she was in charge of her siblings. At the same time, what she was able to do was accomplish amazing things. Now, so one of the things that Royster does is, in her work, is put somebody like Ida B. Wells into a context that has basically been invisible to most people. Most people are surprised when you talk about women, African-American women during a time in which was basically just following the end of slavery, that women were being educated, trained for public speaking, trained to, in a sense, express themselves and find ways to talk about their plight and to find ways to talk about their communities. So Royster really kind of started off this wave of scholarship, looking back at the past and trying to ask questions about forms of education and sites of it that people hadn't thought of before. So Royster is coming then, essentially, she's going to be the keynote, the lead speaker on this lecture. And her purpose is, how do we read Ida B. Wells and think about her legacy? How do we draw on it today? We still live in a community in which there are differences, in which people are trying to speak truth to power. And what does an example? What does somebody? What can somebody like Ida B. Wells teach us about all of that?
Now,
right? Exactly, about now. That's right. And so one of the things that my hopes are, and I've actually talked to Professor Royster about this, and I think she's just going to be fantastic, is that she's somebody who's going to bring the past alive. How did Ida B. Wells become Ida B. Wells? I mean, this is something that that is one of those ironies of history. Something very, very awful happens that then propels her into the stage. Can I tell a story real quick?
Please do. That's right.
Okay. So one of the reasons so why do people think about Ida B. Wells and why do they talk about her? Ida B. Wells, we know that there's was a resident of Chicago for plenty of time. You've got housing projects named after her, elementary schools named after her. She went to Europe and toured Europe, went on speaking tours. W.E.B. Du Bois was a contemporary. So what is it about Ida B. Wells that propelled her into this position? And really the answer to that is starts on in 1892, right here in our community, and that was the lynching of three men. These were men who owned a grocery store, and actually the location of that grocery store has been determined by one of our art history professors who's going to be writing a book on this, and I'm going to talk about her in a second.
Yeah.
But it was called the People's Grocery Store. A grocery store is a black-owned grocery store. And the idea, what apparently had happened is that there was some competition between this black-owned grocery store called the People's Grocery Store and a store in the neighborhood that was owned and operated by a white man. They were across the street from each other, and at some point there was a conflict, and we're not really exactly sure what the conflict was. But in the conflict, a white man was shot. After that occurred, the three men that were the owners of the People's Grocery Store, and one of them was a very close friend of Ida B. Wells, a man named Thomas Moss, they were taken from the grocery store. They were put into jail, and then within a few nights, they were removed from the jail, taken outside of the city limits, killed. Their bodies were mutilated, and then they were just left in the field to rot there. One of the things about Ida B. Wells is that she had known as she grew, was a young black girl growing up in Holly Springs, it's not exactly like she didn't know that there were lynchings going on. She grew up in a climate of fear. You could compare it to a climate of terror.
Yeah.
So she knew all these things, and she hated lynching. But one of the things that one of the myths that people told about lynching at this time was that lynching was really just a very passionate response of white people to crimes that black men basically committed against white women. And what Ida B. Wells did was she kind of had lived, I think, under that, and she admitted it later on. She had lived under the myth that kind of bought into the idea that, well, these are horrific crimes, but the people who were punished, they probably did something wrong. Ida B. Wells knew the people that had been lynched. She knew them very well. She knew what kind of people they were. She knew that this was a farce, that it was a lie, that they had been lynched, that they'd been killed because not for justice, but in the name of something very different, that this was not justice. This was pure, unadulterated terror and racism.
And greed.
And so what does she do? So then what she does is she writes a four-sentence editorial in the newspaper that she worked for at the time here in Memphis. And when she wrote the editorial, within a day of writing the editorial, they went and they burned down the printing press. They, meaning a white mob, did this, and publicly said that if Ida B. Wells ever came to Memphis, something worse was going to happen to her than the people that were lynched. Now, there are conflicting stories about where Ida B. Wells was during all this. There are some folks who actually say she was still hiding out in Memphis. But what the accepted story, at least now, is that Ida B. Wells at that time had she'd gotten out of town and she was already in New York at this point. And from then on, she didn't return to Memphis for many, many years, as you might suspect why. But what does she do? She goes on. Her voice is not at all silenced. Ida B. Wells was not, and recall, at this time, she's not even 30 years old. Okay, she's a young woman, and you can see when some of these great older pictures of Ida B. Wells, you look at her face and you think, this is how could these words and this courage come from this woman? So she goes on after this, and she ends up writing several pamphlets, leading what becomes the first anti-lynching campaign in the history of the United States. And so how does she do this? Well, she goes on speaking tours in Europe and the United States. People in Europe, even though the history of colonialism in places like the United Kingdom surely included lynching and all kinds of violence, people were horrified. They thought, this can't be true. She was so eloquent and she was so forceful in her delivery that she was able to convert a lot of people in Europe to the cause that there was something amiss in the United States that that Reconstruction certainly had not solved.
Yeah.
So that's the context that we're living. We've got a crime that occurred right here in our community over 100 years ago, and here we are 110 years later, and we're talking about it. We're trying to learn from it.
Yeah, and you know, from a historical perspective, if you just tune in, by the way, this is Spotlight 92. We're talking to Dr. Antonio De Velasco, who is the chairperson, organizer, producer of the 13th Biennial Public Address Conference here at the University of Memphis. It's going on the 27th, 28th, and 29th of September. That's today, tomorrow, and Saturday. It will be going on all over campus. And one thing that brings to mind that Ida B. Wells did for lynching in her conversation and what she started doing, the same thing Harriet Beecher Stowe did in bringing on the Civil War.
Yes.
You know, even though all of this rhetoric was going on, all the arguments, all the attitudes, everything was happening, but it didn't come into focus until Uncle Tom's Cabin.
You know, yes.
Ida B. Wells did the same thing about lynching because it was a horrible thing going on.
Right. And of course, you know, after 1892, there were plenty of lynchings that continued to occur.
Kept on all the way until the 30s and until World War II.
Exactly. And so one of the things I think that's – and it's interesting. I think the comparison to Harriet Beecher Stowe is really an interesting one. It's an apt one. And this is a kind of a mystery. Maybe even now it's even more curious because we're surrounded by so much media. How is it that the power of the word – changes people's minds? And what we mean by change people's minds, and I don't think that Ida B. Wells converted somebody who may have been interested or who was sided with the white supremacy to overnight become a different person. But what people like Stowe and people like Ida B. Wells somehow through their talent, and this is part of what we'll be trying to talk about at the conference, is how does she do this? And how can we learn – how can young people in Memphis learn to use their words like Ida B. Wells did? I mean, think of the environment that she lived in.
Yeah.
She lived under a climate of terror. We live under a climate of police brutality, perhaps, unemployment. There are all kinds of challenges that exist in Memphis.
And this is a good way to teach young people how to deal with these things from the perspective of someone who actually could not do anything but talk.
Right. That's right.
Only way to do anything about it was to use the conversation.
I mean, you know, in 1892, African Americans had the franchise by the by law. They the voting rights. Yes. But of course, she's still a woman at this point. She's a woman. So she doesn't get the right to vote for another almost 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's exactly right. And one of the things, too, that's great about Ida B. Wells is when you read her stuff, you don't get the sense that she was mincing words. She was not. Now, there are plenty of people in our history, radical leaders, who are able to speak in a way that somehow they threaten the powers that be, but they find a way to kind of finesse their way through this.
Yeah.
Ida B. Wells was not interested in finesse. That was not her style. So she spoke in a manner that I think might be attractive to a lot of young people and attractive to a lot of people in general who maybe see something like rhetoric as a way to kind of just sweeten your words, to say the nice thing to get what you want. Ida B. Wells didn't have to say anything nice to get what she wanted. She wanted people to listen to her, and she was certainly able to do that to the point where it threatened her own life.
Yeah.
I think that the idea that we can learn something from history is something that when we look at rhetoric, we can learn something very usable. One of the last things I think that you kind of notice about this connection between the past and the present when it comes to Ida B. Wells is that we currently are still in the process of trying to interpret what life in Memphis was like at that point and how that affects now. And so, for example, and I'll talk about this quickly, one of the things that's going to be happening after the talk, okay, so the Ida B. Wells talk is on the 28th, right, Friday?
Yeah, at 4:30.
At 4:30. And after the talk, there's going to be an exhibit of photos. And that is going to be an exhibit of photos that is being put together by art history professor Ernestine Jenkins. Professor Jenkins is also writing a book on African Americans and visual culture in Memphis from the Civil War to Jim Crow. Okay, so what does that mean? What it means is that she's interested in how African Americans used photography use their own pictures, right? This was a time in which people would go to Beale Street. What I mean by people, I mean white people and black people. This was before you had enforced segregation. This was when Memphis was under control by Union troops for the most part early on. And what you had was an entire set of images being created. So, for example, Ida B. Wells liked to have her picture taken. She was interested in how pictures worked. I mean, this was all still pretty new.
This was new stuff, yeah.
The most photographed man of the 19th century was not Abraham Lincoln, but was Frederick Douglass. So there's something about the history of photography and the African-American civil rights struggle that go together. Well, Professor Jenkins is on the trail with that, and so she's going to be showing these photos that have never before been seen. And why is this? Why is this interesting? Well, she's putting up these. She's going to have a set of easels. We're going to be looking at the photographs. One of the things that's interesting is that she has gone around town and identified. For example, when I was talking with her the other day, she's pretty sure she knows exactly the site of the People's Grocery Store where this occurred. When you go there, nobody knows that that's where it happened. And so what is it about that we walk on streets in which this kind of thing has happened and we have no idea that we're doing it? That's a kind of an interesting mystery of life. And so one of the things that I hope that the event will do for people is to get them to appreciate that not only do we live in a city with a history, but that history is very much alive.
And still easy to see. I mean, if you ever think about the idea that there's an auction street and a block still down
there, right.
You know exactly what happened right there.
That's exactly right. I mean, these are not these are signs of what seems like another time. But one of the things that I think that I think is kind of important to recall is that, you know, the history of Memphis, especially when it comes to after slavery and after the end of the Civil War, is distinctive. Why is it distinctive? Well, one of the reasons it's distinctive is that a lot of former slaves, and these were right in particular men who could serve as soldiers in the Union Army, were stationed here in Memphis. These were armed African-American men at the end of the 19th century. This was something very threatening to the white power structure. These men were, in a sense, Memphis was a safe haven for not only them but their families too. This was a place in which the reach of white supremacy and the reach of that kind of terror was not able to extend easily or as easily into Memphis. There were safe havens in this city. And so, in a sense, you could say that Memphis really from the beginning, especially from after the end of the Civil War, and of course we got things like the yellow fever epidemic that play into this, has been an African-American city for well over 100 years. That is to say that it's been identified with the black civil rights struggle. And yet, when we talk about the city today, we talk about the history in a very different way. It's almost as if we forget about what was going on in many ways before the 1960s, right? Because we talk a lot about that when we talk about civil rights in Memphis, obviously because of Dr. King.
That's something that that has come up in several discussions with myself and David Acey and some others, that so many young people think of the history of African Americans in America as they were slaves. And then it was the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
They have no clue of what went on in between those 50
years.
In between there.
Between
100 years between, actually.
Yeah, you could have something like the Civil War be fought and hundreds of thousands of people killed, maimed, freedom from slavery. These are dramatic episodes that happen. And then suddenly somehow nothing happens until the 1950s? No.
Yeah.
There was a back and forth, a period of struggle. That needs to be illuminated and needs to be talked about. And that's the kind of thing that this lecture is supposed to do.
Well, that's going to be a great Ida B. Wells Legacy for Civic Action and Leadership from a Truth-Telling Woman. It begins at 4:30 p.m., room 250 in the Arts Communication Building. It's at 3715 Central Avenue.
Yes.
And it will be the guest lecturer is Jacqueline Jones Royster. And she is, again, the dean of Ivan Allen College of Liberal Arts at Georgia Tech. And that's Friday, September the 28th, tomorrow.
Yeah.
Today,
yes.
This evening at 6:30, it will be – this is Thursday, September 27th.
That's right.
University Center at the University of Memphis, the reception at 6 p.m., a lecture at 6:30 p.m., the book signing to follow. And this is about partisanship and the presidency.
Yes. Let me just say one other thing about tomorrow's lecture, about the Friday lecture, is that parking is available in the central parking lot. So one of the things that people – we have an issue sometimes on our campus is that – However open to the community we are when it comes to things like parking and accessibility, we're less so.
Well, let's also let everybody know that, that it's not just the community that has to suffer, because we suffer too.
No, that's that's for sure.
We get our share of tickets.
We definitely do. I get them all the time. Yes, I do. I do. But the good thing is that if you come for the Friday lecture at 4:30, is that once 4 o'clock hits, you won't be ticketed. So it's the central parking lot, which is the lot that's just east of the Holiday Inn University of Memphis. Right. You could park in there, come across the street to the Art and Communication Building. There'll be ushers. You'll see signs. It shouldn't be too hard to get to.
Yeah, and you can recognize the Pharaoh. He'll be standing there.
Yes,
standing
that's right. In our building, the Art and Communication Building is the one that's surrounded in scaffolding.
Yeah.
They're fixing our roof.
But this lecture this evening at 6:30 about the presidency, which is so timely because the election is coming up in November, and we got to talk about that too.
Yeah.
This one is Carlin Campbell, who's professor of communication studies at the University of Minnesota, and author of 8 books, including Deeds Done in Words, Presidential Rhetoric, and the Genres of Governance, and this Partisanship and Presidency. This is her latest release.
So this is something. This is another event that we're really, really happy to be able to open to the public. And this event is going to occur in the University Center. And so parking for this is available in the Zach Curlin parking garage. It's a different part of the campus. So if you're at home and you've got access to the internet and you don't know our campus very well, make sure that you note that the lecture tonight is the lecture at the University Center, and the lecture tomorrow night is at the Art and Communication Building. So tonight, Carlin Campbell, who Malvin talked about, you talked about the fact that she's published 8 books. I mean, this is somebody who does not rest.
Yeah.
She has been actively at this now for almost 40 years. She is. She actually came up at pretty much the same time as our late department chair, Michael Leftit.
Mike left, yeah.
And so she has been involved in teaching and doing research on rhetoric and public speaking, and in particular the presidency, for quite a long time. So what is she going to be talking about tonight? Well, we're in the middle of a presidential election. We've got debates that are going to be coming in just, I think, about 10 days, maybe even less than that. And so one of the things that hasn't been discussed as much in this campaign but is extremely important, and that is the issue of foreign policy. How is it that our presidents lead us in times of great national and international concern and confusion? And maybe you could say that we've always been in those times, but now in particular is something very interesting. We've got the Islamic Republic of Iran. The United States is you hear all kinds of rattling of the sabers.
Right.
Is the United States prepared to go to war again if this country acquires nuclear weapons? A few days ago, President Obama went to the United Nations and he declared unequivocally that the United States would not tolerate nuclear Iran. Well, that seems to me like a threat. What Professor Campbell is going to be looking at is the history of these kinds of actions, right? How it is that presidents since Lyndon Johnson have engaged our country in several.
What about Jack Kennedy and Bay of Pigs?
Bay of Pigs, that's an interesting one too, right? Right through the CIA. How is it that over the past 40 years, our blood and our treasure have been expended with great facility? I mean, it's almost hard to imagine a president since 1968 who hasn't committed our military to some kind of action. And some of them have been quite significant, as recent memory teaches us. Well, when presidents do this, they haven't gotten a declaration of war in quite a while since the Korean War.
Yeah.
So how do they talk to the nation about this? How do presidents explain the need to go to war? What are the kinds of phrases that they use, and what do we need to be on the lookout for today? So one of the things that Campbell is going to be doing is that she's going to be looking at the history of how presidents have used, in particular, the Monroe Doctrine, which was a document that said specifically that the United States would not allow for any intervention into our hemisphere. And what it said was the United States basically had a military right not only to defend its interests, but to project that interest across a great span of the globe. And this is something that has been essential to growing up in the United States for quite a long time. We grow up learning that this is part of what our presidents do.
Yeah.
Well, Campbell's going to kind of complicate that a little bit. And the way that she's going to do it is she's going to look at the way that different presidents have used this in the political sphere. So right now, in fact, just a few days ago, Mitt Romney went on television and criticized Barack Obama for his his actions in the Middle East, and that is he essentially blamed Obama for the United States Embassy in Libya being attacked and our ambassador being killed. These are campaign issues. They're partisan issues, but they're also issues of foreign policy. That's what she's going to be addressing.
Right. Well, that's from the Marcus W. Orr Center for the Humanities. We're very proud to have that stationed right here at the University of Memphis. And as always, goodness, Tony, I've talked to you for hours about this.
Oh, I know. Me too.
But the conference, it's the 13th Biennial Public Address Conference here at the University of Memphis. It's going on for 3 days. And if you want more information about what's happening, listen to the station because we're talking about it all the time.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
also you can call 901-678-3185, 901-678-3185. And you can get all the information on the events that are going on. It's from September 27th to the 9th. And it's something that you want to be involved in. It's something you want to, if you want to learn something about communication, this is some place to be.
That's exactly right. That's exactly
right. Dr. Antonio De Valesco.
Thank you, Doc. Malvin. Thank you.
All right. And this has been Spotlight 92. We'll do it again next week. In the meantime, you're back for more of the best in jazz. This is U92 FM.